You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Locus Focus Talk Radio with Barbara Bernstein and today's guest, Bob Salinger, for a discussion on wake-free zones near Ross Island.
Tune into the KBOO Yiddish Hour on Sunday, March 29th, as we look at the concepts of eco-kashrut, a growing movement to reinterpret Jewish dietary laws. Eco-kashrut expands on traditional kosher practice by incorporating the ethics of sustainable growing systems, humane animal production, and fair treatment for farm workers. We'll be talking to some of the movement's primary shapers, as well as a couple of Portland's own Jewish organic farmers. So save the date, Sunday, March 29th at 10 a.m., right here on KBOO, and tell your friends.
This is Pat McGuire. I'm the host of Boneheads and Bigots. Join us on KBOO at our new time. We're on the third Friday of every month at 11 o'clock a.m. And you know Boneheads and Bigots. We talk about politics. We talk about anti-democratic elements in politics. We talk about public affairs. We talk about books. And we always talk about music. So join us at our new time. That means in March, we're going to be on Friday, March 20th at 11 o'clock a.m.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call-in talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, where the time is about 3 minutes after 8 o'clock. And the number to call to join the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. This morning we're going to be talking about a couple of significant wild places in Portland that are in need of great protection. Between Ross Island and the east bank of the Willamette lies the Holgate Channel, a patch of wild nature only a couple miles south from downtown Portland. And sitting above the river on the east bank with osprey and eagles and blue heron as your companions, you have no idea that you're anywhere near the city, except for the roar of the jet skis and the motorboats, and not to mention the bass-enhanced stereo systems booming across the river. My guest this morning, Bob Salinger, who is the Urban Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society, has been working hard to create a wake-free zone in the Holgate Channel and ban motorized craft outright from neighboring Ross Island Lagoon. So welcome to Locus Focus, Bob.
Good morning.
So why is it important, besides the fact that when I go hang out on the river, I get really tired of all the noises that distract from the nature that I'm trying to commune with, why is it important for other factors to have less motorized presence in the Holgate Channel?
Well, we have this incredible resource in the middle of the city of Portland. There's really very little like it out there in other cities, with Ross Island and Oaks Bottom and the Holgate Channel, this incredible natural area complex that we're very, very fortunate to have. But we don't always treat it very well. And if you go out there today, what you'll see is tons of motorboats and wakeboarders and jet skis. And it's not that there's anything wrong with those activities. It's just that they don't belong everywhere. And so what Audubon Urban Green Spaces Institute and Willamette Creek Riverkeeper have proposed is to create a no-wake zone in the Holgate Channel, so east of the islands between Ross Island and Oaks Bottom, and a no-motorized zone actually in the Ross Island Lagoon. And we believe that's essential, first and foremost, for safety of paddlers in that area, for people that go out there to experience nature, but also to help protect the ecology of the islands and Oaks Bottom as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about exactly where we're talking about in the river. For people who aren't real familiar with Ross Island, where is this, and what exactly is the Holgate Channel?
Well, Ross Island is south of downtown Portland, across from South Waterfront on the west, and then Oaks Bottom on the east. And it's actually a complex of four islands that have been used historically for mining sand and gravel, the sand and gravel that actually made the city of Portland. Most of the materials, the raw materials for that built this downtown skyline, came from the Ross Island Lagoon, and it was eventually dug out from a depth of about 20 feet to about 120 feet today. But in recent years, there's been a move toward really conserving and protecting the island, and that culminated about 2 years ago with a donation of 40 acres to the city of Portland. The Holgate Channel runs between Ross Island and Oaks Bottom, the natural area on the shore. And it's a narrow channel that's used primarily by kayakers and canoers, and then occasionally high-speed motorized activity. West of the island is the main channel of the Willamette, and we're not proposing any changes there. So the key point here is to understand that there'd be a narrow channel between the islands and the Oaks Bottom natural area that would be restricted, but the main channel would be still fully motorized.
And what is the Ross Island Lagoon? Was there always a lagoon there, or is that basically the result of a lot of mining activity?
Well, originally there wasn't a lagoon because the islands were actually separated, and the Corps of Engineers back in the early part of the last century actually connected them, and that created a lagoon, but it was a shallow water lagoon. It was only about 20 feet deep, and it was dredged out and dug out, again, for the purposes of mining raw materials to create the downtown skyline by the Ross Island Sand and Gravel Company. They ceased mining operations there at the end of the 1990s in recognition of Endangered Species Act issues, need to protect salmon and steelhead. They stopped mining there, and under a reclamation agreement, they're actually refilling significant portions of the lagoon to create wildlife habitat.
So if you go by the lagoon, I mean, what you can see, the two best ways I know to see the lagoon is either to bicycle along the Springwater Corridor or to go hang out at the Veterans Hospital or the OSHU. And if you walk on the skywalk between the two, you get a really great view of the lagoon from there.
Absolutely.
But right now there's big piles of, looks like piles of debris there. So are those piles of debris things that are going back into the lagoon now? Or?
Well, there are barges full of sand and gravel and dirt, and that's actually coming out of the big pipe that we're digging to deal with stormwater issues and combined sewer overflows. The materials from that, and those are clean materials, are being moved over to Ross Island on barges and then put back in the lagoon to refill it to create shallow water habitat for fish and other wildlife. A lot of people assume that they're still dredging because they see the barges out there and they're full of materials, and they think, oh, they're still doing mining operations. They're not.
This is reverse mining.
Yeah, it's reverse mining. The other thing that's still going on out there, though, is Ross Island Sand and Gravel still owns a significant portion of the island, and they have a facility out there that processes sand and gravel, and they bring in raw materials from the Columbia River Gorge and process them on the island. So they're still processing there. They're still using their industrial operations there. They're just not mining the lagoon itself any longer.
So is Ross Island always going to remain partially commercial and partially a natural area?
Well, we don't know when Ross Island Sand and Gravel will leave or if they're going to leave. Dr. Pamplin, who owns Ross Island Sand and Gravel, hasn't given an indication of that. But they're doing You know, they're processing out there. The main thing is by 2013, they have to finish their reclamation agreement, which means they'll fill up significant portions of the lagoon and create a shallow water habitat. And that does have a strict timeline of 2013. In the meantime, though, there are basically three owners out there. The Port of Portland owns the north tip of the island. That's sort of a remnant holding that they have from back when they had channel markers out there. They no longer use it for that. The City of Portland owns sort of the central piece of the islands where the bald eagles nest. And then Ross Island Sand and Gravel owns the southern piece. And Audubon, Urban Green Spaces Institute, Willamette Riverkeeper, and others have been working together with the city to start to begin the process of developing a management plan, ideally for the whole island. They really need to be managed as a complete entity. For example, it doesn't make sense for the city to remove invasive species on their piece of property, but not to have the port do the same. They'll just rapidly reinfest. And so what we really need out there is a unified management plan. But the first step that we've taken is to go for this no-wake zone in the Holgate Channel and this no-motorized zone in the Ross Island Lagoon. And that's really driven by years and years of leading field trips out there. All three organizations lead field trips out there, and we've seen the impacts. Most importantly, though, to safety. We've all had enough really bad experiences out there with high-speed activity that we felt it was time to act.
Well, I'm talking with Bob Salinger, who is the Urban Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society, and along with Mike Houck with Urban Green Spaces Institute, and Travis Williams, who's the Willamette Riverkeeper.
Willamette Riverkeeper.
And they are working to create a no-wake zone in the Holgate Channel, which we've just been describing along in the Willamette River. You can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187 and joining the conversation. Let's talk a little bit about what a no-wake zone means.
Yeah, a no-wake zone basically means that you can't go faster than 5 miles an hour. And 5 miles an hour is the speed that the Oregon Marine Board feels is slow enough that you wouldn't actually create significant wakes. And so in the Ross, in the Holgate Channel, you'll essentially be able to go up to 5 miles an hour. And then in the lagoon, what we're proposing is a non-motorized zone. That means you wouldn't be able to use motorized you wouldn't be able to use your motors at all in there. It does exempt commercial activity. So the Ross Island Sand and Gravel Company would still be able to do what they do. The Stern Wheeler, which goes up and down there sometimes, would be able to do what it does. But for the general public, they would be restricted in terms of their activities. But, you know, I think the thing to understand is that the entire lower Willamette is open to those kinds of activities. West of the islands on the Willamette is open to those kinds of activities. So it's not that they won't be able to do them on the lower Willamette. It's that we're taking back a very small piece of the river, really a tiny piece, and saying there ought to be a place where you can go and be safe, bring your kids in a canoe or a kayak, not be worried about being swamped or hit, and be able to hear nature and see nature. Because obviously the more activity and the more loud activity you have, the less wildlife is going to be visible.
And does the no-wake zone include a no-stereo zone? Because, I mean, seriously, I mean, I find that I don't enjoy the wakes. When I'm out on the river, and I'm not even that crazy about them when I'm on the shore, really don't enjoy the motors. But it's something about those incredible ultra-bass sound systems on some of these boats that I find really difficult to deal with.
We'll be talking to the city noise ordinance officer about that as well. This doesn't affect that directly, but our hope is that when you take away the high-speed activity, it will become a less appealing place to go and party and blast your boom boxes and, you know, drink beer. And, you know, really, most of the time you go in the lagoon, especially during the spring and summer, you find tons of party boats rafted up. But usually that's in conjunction with wakeboarding or jet skiing or water skiing.
But jet skiing would be totally that won't be allowed at all because you can't really go 5 miles an hour on a jet ski.
I've never ridden a jet ski, so I don't know. But if you're going to go in there, you'd have to go very, very slowly in the channel. And again, no motorized in the lagoon.
So I'm wondering if people were limited to 5 miles an hour in the channel, if they would just decide, well, that's no fun, and they'll just go along on the west side of the island and leave us alone.
Well, that's the hope with the sort of the partying activity. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with partying, but there are some places that it's more and less appropriate, and we would argue that a natural area, a designated natural area, and something that's as unique as Ross Island and Oaks Bottom really are not the places for that. So, yeah, exactly. The hope is that that kind of activity would move away from the natural area. And, you know, the letters of support we've gotten are amazing. This hasn't happened yet. We're bringing it to the Oregon Marine Board as a petition. We have over 300 letters of support. And I think the thing that's really striking in those letters is how many people could talk from firsthand experience about really dangerous experiences they had out there. We've had boats hit, boats cut in half, shells cut in half. We've had a lot of people with some very frightening experiences. So the support's been overwhelming. We've heard from just hundreds of people now.
And today, what's happening at City Council?
City Council is hopefully going to pass a resolution supporting the no-wake zone and non-motorized zone. It doesn't have any force of law. It's more of a symbolic gesture, but it puts City Council on record as supporting this petition to the Oregon Marine Board. And that's very significant because obviously the Oregon Marine Board wants to know that the city is behind it. And we've been working hand in hand with Portland Parks and Bureau of Environmental Services and their ecologists on this as well. And a secondary factor really is protecting the ecology of the island. That high-speed activity causes erosion. It disrupts wildlife activity. It certainly keeps wildlife from being visible and audible. So those are secondary things that we hope will improve. It doesn't solve those problems, obviously. There's a lot of factors involved in restoring the islands to a healthy natural state. But it's a step in the right direction for those reasons as well.
Well, in a moment, we can talk a bit more about the ecology and why limiting fast boat use and jet ski use in very sensitive areas is not just harmful for those of us canoeing, or kayaking, or sitting on the banks trying to listen to the wildlife. But we want to take some phone calls, and you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. And I'm talking with Bob Salinger, who is the Urban Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society, and we're talking about creating a wake-free zone in the Holgate Channel, which runs on the east side of Ross Island, between Ross Island and the Willamette River. Again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. We have Daniel on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have two quick questions. First of all, I'd like to say that we regularly enjoy the Hawthorne Channel for water skiing in the early morning hours, and whenever we are out there, there are typically no boats or kayaks. But I would like to ask, first of all, whether you would agree with a correction when you said that the channel is enjoyed mostly by kayakers and canoeists, I suppose. I posit that the channel is enjoyed mostly by motorized recreation.
I would say that, I think the channel is appropriately enjoyed by kayakers and canoeists, and I would argue during the summertime they're probably the predominant users out there. There's certainly a heck of a lot of jet skis and water skiers and wakeboarders out there, but again, our position is that those things belong elsewhere. A designated natural area and something as unique as this in the middle of the city of Portland ought to be protected, and certain kinds of uses aren't appropriate. And I know there are folks that are out there that disagree with us, but the reality is that they have the entire lower Willamette to use for those purposes. And there ought to be at least, you know, one place on the lower Willamette where folks can go out and safely paddle and enjoy themselves and enjoy nature. And in some cases, you know, unfortunately, different kinds of activities are mutually exclusive. If you do one, the other really isn't available to folks. So that's our position, and that's how we're moving forward.
One more question, please.
Sure.
I was just down at Oaks Park about 2 days ago. Saw a golden eagle there in the park, right next to a motorized amusement, you know, ride going on. And when we're in the Hawthorne Channel, we regularly see wildlife and so forth. So I posit that the activities of the city and the citizens enjoying this resource are not particularly disruptive to wildlife. On the other hand, making this resource available for the citizens to enjoy our natural resource and the beauty of this channel is really a resource that people ought to be make it available for them to use it and enjoy it. And therefore, the things that get people out, especially for this channel, so close to our community, is really a resource that ought to be enjoyed by everybody, including motorized transport.
Well, actually, for, one correction, it's actually the Holgate channel, not the Hawthorne channel.
Right, correct.
And I also don't think you saw a golden eagle. What, there are a whole lot of juvenile bald eagles that are now flying around in Oaks Bottom. And I'd be very surprised if you saw an adult bald eagle sitting by any of the motorized rides in Oaks Park. The young ones are a little
golden.
Bit... What's that?
Golden eagle, a large eagle, not...
They're very... No, the juvenile... I'm very familiar with these. I live right above the bluff, and I've been seeing these juvenile bald eagles, and they're actually larger than the adults. They get a little bigger before they grow up. And I... anyway, the juveniles, and Bob knows a lot more about this than I do, but they're a lot more adventurous, I'd say, than the adults, and maybe a little bit more reckless, as other teenage humans are.
Well, you know, I mean, two things. I mean, one, it probably was a juvenile bald eagle, which are brown, and a lot of people mistake them for golden eagles because they don't have the white heads or white tails. But that's really not the point. I mean, I get your point, which is that you saw wildlife near human activity, and you will see wildlife near human activity. You know, we have redtails nesting on downtown fire escapes. We have peregrines nesting on bridges. You know, we have wildlife all over the city. But, you know, studies have shown that for a lot of species, if you have a lot of human activity around them, you will get nesting suppression. It's a hard thing to document because you have to prove that something is not there because of activity. And so, you know, you have to kind of do before and after studies show that without the activity, wildlife increases. With the activity, wildlife decreases. But there are plenty of studies out there that show that those kinds of things happen. And so, again, in a natural area, it makes sense to reduce the more disturbing activities and allow it to, you know, serve the highest possible wildlife protection values as you can achieve. As far as eagles go, though, you know, if you go into the lagoon, you'll now see signs that tell all users, whether they're motorized or non-motorized, to stay back 330 feet from the eagle nest. Basically, stay back behind these signs is what they say. And the reason for doing that is that U.S. Fish and Wildlife guidelines call for eagle protection zones to keep them from being disturbed. And, you know, people say, well, I went close to them and they weren't disturbed. That may be very well be true, but the reality is it's cumulative. And over time, as those impacts get higher and higher and higher and more people are getting closer and closer, eventually it does have an effect and eventually they do leave. Is it the first time it happens or the 10th time or the 100th time? Not necessarily, but at some point those impacts get high enough that you lose that value that you were originally seeking to protect. So, you know, I get what you're saying in terms of seeing wildlife around human activity, but it you know, there's definitely plenty of research that shows that it makes sense to limit that kind of thing in a natural area. As far as people enjoying the channel, we're not saying people shouldn't enjoy it. We're saying that the type of ways that people access it ought to be limited. And anyone can go out there and canoe or kayak or putter through the Holgate Channel. We're not limiting the number of people who can go there or even in the channel how they get there. They can use their motors. They can use their paddles. We're simply saying don't go blasting through it. And, you know, that's again, that's our perspective. I understand there are folks out there that disagree.
I would also say, though, that I think if you really want to enjoy wildlife, it's pretty hard to enjoy a wildlife blasting through a natural area at 30, I don't know how fast boats go, 30 miles an hour or whatever, making a lot of noise. That it's. I know that when I've gone out paddling and kayaking, I see an awful lot more than I do when I'm in a motorized craft, and I think it's analogous. The difference, the reason why there's no dirt bikes allowed in Oaks Bottom, or for that matter, actually, motorized or non-motorized dirt bikes, that you, when you're in a very sensitive area, it's much better to be on foot than it is to be, on the ground, it's better to be on foot than rolling through, riding your bicycle 15, 20 miles an hour through it. And the same thing is true when you're in the water, that it, going a lot slower, you're going to really understand and appreciate and connect with the wildlife there on a much deeper level.
Can I make a final comment?
Sure.
I agree with what you say about really appreciation and the depth of, you know, understanding about ecology when one travels on foot or in a kayak. Of course, I grasp that. My personal background is that, you know, I was just a kid who rode my bicycle around Oaks Park and around Oaks Bottom, and then I started water skiing, and then I started skiing. And the fact that we get out into the wild places in developed areas like ski resorts, like Hawthorne Channel, has increased my commitment to resource conservation and to wilderness. So the fact that this particular area is so close to our city is, I think, brings people into environmental consciousness. And I think a mixed use, you know, application for this area is appropriate because it's so close.
Okay, well, actually, we're going to be talking a little bit more about some of the environmental impacts that motorized vehicles in the Holgate Channel have, and so and we need to take some more callers. So you keep listening, and maybe you'll get a sense of why Bob's taking the position that he's taking. But thanks for calling.
And I want to bring it back to the safety issue, too, though, because that's first and foremost. And, you know, the wildlife impacts, the erosion impacts are really, for us, important but secondary. The reality was that increasingly we can't take trips out there because the activity is such high speed and so dangerous, and we really felt we needed to take a step. So in some ways, continuing to allow the kind of activity that we're seeing out there and seeing it increasing in the way it has been increasing over recent years would preclude other kinds of activity, namely the non-motorized.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. And I'm talking this morning with Bob Solinger, who is the Urban Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society, and we're talking about protecting some of these very amazing natural spaces that we have in Portland. Right now we're talking about the Holgate Channel, and we'll be shortly talking about another place not quite as close to downtown Portland, West Hayden Island, which Bob has been working on for 10 years, I guess, trying to protect what's left of Hayden Island.
Too long,
he says. Anyway, if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 25 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Jeff is on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Barb. Thank you. And Bob, thank you for your hard work over these many years. And the Holgate Channel is a very precious place. I'm looking at my map here, Barb, and, from the USGS, the topo maps. And I love them because they're so accurate. And literally there are four. It's a four-island group. And it's part of that whole ecosystem, including Oaks Bottom and Oaks Park to the south. And then there's Ross Island, Hardtack Island, Toe Island on the west, and then East Island on the southeast. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Bob, there are people living on East Island.
Not officially.
No. Yeah, no, there's nobody living on East Island.
Yeah.
Definitely homeless camps out on the island, so.
That's right, because now I think about it, of course, they're actually north of Oaks Park, the amusement park in Carmel.
There's a moorage. I have actually a really good friend who lives in the moorage that is right, it's just at the mouth of the Holgate Channel, the south end of it. And it's pretty old moorage, except that it used to just have a handful of houses, and now there's a lot of houseboats on it.
And everybody has a boat, right?
Yeah, one boat at least. And it's an amazing place. I never was out there until my friend moved there last year, and I thought I had a nice view of the nature living above the bluff. But, I mean, it's an incredible place. And we had a long conversation about the problem with the motorboats going through the channel. And the people who live on that moorage are really supporting Bob's proposal to make it a wake-free zone.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, Bob and Barb, if maybe this is an idea that could work. Just north of East Island, connecting private, gated, inaccessible fashion, a floating bridge, if you will, that will obviously stop all traffic except row traffic and rowboats and canoes and the like, and kayaks, but a floating bridge that would be inaccessible in some way, a secure bridge, but a floating bridge, literally kind of mark it off. And I'm wondering if that's an idea. I'll wait for your answer. I'll listen on the air.
Okay.
And
thanks for calling.
Thank you for the question. Well, you know, we think the no wake zone is probably sufficient. If we can get some signs up there that basically say 5 miles an hour or less at the north and south entrances to the Holgate Channel, and then no motorized in the lagoon, we think that'll be sufficient. It won't stop everybody. There's always folks who are going to do what they want to do. But we think it'll cut down on the activity dramatically, and there'll be enforcement options as well with the sheriff and so on. So, you know, we think that should be more than sufficient to address the issues we're seeing out there. You know, and still allow people to go through. And I think that's an important concept to understand, is that we're not saying in the Holgate Channel that you can't go there in your motorboat. We're just saying go slowly. Enjoy nature. Stop, listen, look around, and pass through slowly if you're going to go there. And, again, the sport's been amazing. You know, we talked to all the rowing groups out there that row through there, and they usually have support boats. And they all came on board right away and were very supportive. We've talked to neighborhood groups. We talked to the floating home community. So we have over 300 letters of support. I mean, of all the things I've worked on in nearly 17 years of working in Portland Audubon, I can't remember anything that generated this many support letters this quickly and this easily, and really, honestly, so little opposition. There's been very, very little concern out there, and even a lot of motorized users have come and said, yeah, you know, we can... That's fine with us. We can live with that. There ought to be a place.
You know, it's kind of it's an interesting concept of slowing down. I remember friend of ours, actually, he's a friend of Kibu's, Tim Calvert, who works Kitty Corner at the bike store across the way, and he's called the show a number of times talking about the Springwater Corridor, and he's a real avid and I think rather fast bike rider, but he was telling me that once the Springwater Corridor went in, that he started biking slower and slower and slower because there's so many amazing things that he would see. And I find whenever I use the Springwater Corridor as my slow route, not my fast route, even though it is the bike freeway, but I go really slowly through that, and I use that route when I have the time to really enjoy what's there. And I think it's one of the things that when people understand, when you're in a natural area that is not a place to do, you know, either to power walk or power bike or motorbike or whatever, or motorboat, that you just have a whole different experience, and that it's all part of the slowing down of our culture that would be very helpful for all of us, for our mental health and also for the health of the wildlife around. I'm just thinking that there's a couple bald eagles that we saw a couple of days ago on the top of the bluff, and the caller who was talking about how wildlife is not affected by humans. I think that it's great when the wildlife decides to come to us, and this pair of bald eagles, it was very close to the top of the bluff and very visible to everybody who was walking by, and people were taking photographs and looking binoculars, and it was a wonderful moment. But I think that it's a real great moment. If you slow down, you can appreciate the wildlife coming to you. But expecting the wildlife to just be putting up with all of our noise and racket is maybe a little bit arrogant on the part of humans.
Well, and some will and some won't. You know, it's individual variation. But overall, your diversity is going to go down, and your nesting success and things like that with the higher level of disruption. And again, there are thresholds, and we don't know exactly where they are for any given individual animals, but we know that there are certainly lots of research that shows you that as you get closer and as you get louder, you lose that diversity over time.
It's interesting with these bald eagles. We had this fantasy because they were sitting very, very close on the branch together. We're thinking maybe this is a nesting pair, because it's very hard to tell males from females, especially when we're about 20 feet away. But
the females are bigger usually. The females, there's a reverse sexual dimorphism. So females are bigger with a lot of raptor species. You know, the last piece, you know, in terms of the no-wake zone is really the erosion issues. And again, this is really a secondary thing. There are a lot of things that cause erosion, river level fluctuations, flooding events, and those kinds of things. But the island is heavily, heavily eroded. If you go by it, you just see the banks are just cut. And so, you know, this is one way to reduce it on one side of the island. It doesn't deal with the issues on the west side. But, you know, it should help that as well. And we're looking at a lot of different options to deal with erosion. One of the things we've talked about doing is putting back in some of the log rafts that were historically there as a buffer, not necessarily, you know, 30, 40 wide, but one or two, just as a way of stopping that wave action on the shores. The other thing that's coming up that we're real excited about now that part of the island is in public ownership is Audubon and Willamette River Keeper, and UGI will be running some trips out there with Portland Parks. That right now there's no public access on the island itself. You can go around it, but you can't really step on it. But we're going to get some restoration teams out there to pick up garbage, to remove invasive species, and to start restoring the ecology of the island. So we'll be doing four trips in conjunction with Willamette River Keeper and Portland Parks this summer to go out there and actually get, you know, work parties of 25 people out there on the island, boots on the ground, to start fixing the place up.
So if you want to go out and see Ross Island and get your feet on the ground there, you have to work, basically.
You have to work, you know, but I think it's exciting because I think as people start to see folks out there restoring the island and working on it and taking care of it, I think, you know, that's as powerful a message as you can send, and then people will start treating it better. Right now, it's kind of a neglected place, you know, really has... Because the city didn't have a foothold out there, there was really nothing the city could do. And so, you know, it's been allowed to deteriorate. It's covered with invasive species. If you go out there and look at the beaches, they're just covered in garbage. And, you know, we can start taking care of the place.
I think about 8 years ago, during one of the really low water summers, my friend and I kayaked, or we rafted, this little rubber raft, and we rafted out to Ross Island, and it was almost like scraping the bottom of the river as we were like going, it was so low. And we got out there, and it was the only time I ever actually walked around Ross Island, and we were on the southern tip of the island, and it it was a very desolate place. It was kind of interesting. You could see it, the potential for it to be a really beautiful spot, but it seemed like it was such a wasted place, and it reminded me in a way of what used to be Selwood Riverfront Park before it was turned into a park. And you know, it was just piles of sawdust and blackberries growing on it. This was not piles of sawdust, but it was like gravel heaps, and it really gave you a sense of how much work it would take to restore it, and also what kind of a crime it was that this island has been abused and neglected to the state that it has been.
It is sad, but, you know, it's amazing, too, because it's one of the few remnants we have left. So we've done a lot more to most of the rest of the landscape. So it's one of the places we still have an opportunity to go back and restore. And one part of the agreement with Ross Island Sand and Gravel when the city took its 40 acres was that they gave $100,000 as well to support invasive species removal. Now, that'll be just a small fraction of what it costs, but it at least gives us a start. And so we're excited, you know. We can start turning it back, and Ross Island Sand and Gravel is already doing some of that work with the lagoon restoration. Right now, if you go in, basically it's a giant hole, a very deep hole with steep sides. But at the north and south end of the lagoon, you'll eventually see shallow water immersion habitat coming up. So it'll be very exciting over the next 5 or 6 years to see that happen. And the diversity out there should increase immensely as that happens as well. It'll be good for birds, good for fish. And Ross Island is actually a designated important bird area. Important bird areas are an internationally recognized designation. There's about 120 in Oregon and about 2,000 nationwide and about 10,000 worldwide. But it's actually recognized as an important bird area because, in part, it's sort of this remnant on an otherwise very developed landscape.
I will say that it's the important bird area certainly spills into our neighborhood, and I would imagine if you enhance it. I mean, I was talking to somebody who was talking about being up in Alaska and seeing 20 bald eagles in a tree and how, you know, amazing it was. And I said, well, I don't see 20 in a tree in Oak's Bottom, but I have seen 5. And the person looked at me like, 5 bald eagles in a tree in a city? So I feel that there's so much there already. And so maybe if Ross Island is really rebuilt in a natural way, we will see 20 bald eagles in one tree in Oak's Bottom.
Yeah, you know, the motto we always use is that the island gave to the city. Now it's time for the city to get back to the island. And I think that really is a very appropriate way to think about it. I mean, again, the downtown skyline was basically built out of materials from the Ross Island Lagoon. And the island has been used and abused, and now it's going to be restored.
Well, I'm very excited about that. And so we're talking this morning about Bob Salinger this morning about what we've been talking about, protecting the Holgate Channel around the Ross Island. And we're going to move now into talking about another area that really needs to be protected, which is Hayden Island. But I think we have a couple callers still on queue. So I imagine they still want to talk about Ross Island. So we'll finish up with that, and then we're going to move north about 10 miles to the mouth of the Willamette River. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. We have Gordon on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. So, great topic. There's a couple of things that I'd like to mention here. I know, number one, Ross Island made humongous amounts of profit from destroying that place. And we're dealing with this in Oregon City with the landfill, and now they want to come and develop under urban renewal this landfill. And guess who walked away? The man who destroyed that space and made a profit. And so there's a problem there where these people are making profit destroying public land. Even though it's kind of private, it's public. And that's what we're talking about here is we're talking about people controlling the public. And my whole thing is, I think there should be no boats on the river at all. That's our drinking water. Why are we spewing out petroleum products and carcinogenic products into our drinking water? Are we the most stupidest people on the planet? I mean, we are the most stupidest species on the planet. We're spewing out petroleum products out of boats into our drinking water. And so that's got to be curbed. But also, I'm also hearing this thing where, Barbara, your opinions matter more than other people's opinions. Your opinion, you don't have the right to push your opinion on me, just like nobody has the right to push their religion on me. Just because you see more wildlife because you paddle doesn't mean that I don't see it when I'm on a boat. That's your opinion. You're right to it, but you don't have the right to push it on me. But I also am in agreement
We got some other calls. We'll move on. So thanks a whole lot for calling. And I don't know that anybody's drinking out of the Willamette River yet, except maybe Wilsonville. But I hope nobody's drinking out of the Willamette River.
Well, and just to be clear how the process moves forward. I mean, we're going to petition the Marine Board. We're going to send our petition in April, along with 300-plus letters of support. And the Marine Board will ultimately decide. And we'll need strong support when we go before them. We're going to make our case primarily on safety, but also secondarily on the ecology. We'll go from there, and we'll see if they agree with us or disagree with us. Ultimately, they're going to be the body that decides whether this is appropriate or not. And we're hopeful that they will.
I think we got one more caller about Ross Island, and we're going to move over to Hayden Island. So we got Sean on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
And I live in a sort of a rural area close to Portland. I see quite a lot of wildlife. Saw some elk yesterday. But I even come into the city. You know, if I come in with the kids to go to OMSI or that, we'll park down in Selwood, use that spring water corridor. And usually I've done it in the spring and winter and that, or when there's not too many motorboats on the river. And it is sort of a pleasure not to have. I can't imagine being there and seeing these motorboats coming tearing down. So I just really am supportive of what you're trying to do there. It seems like there's so many areas around where there's motorized vehicles, whether it's on water or land or whatever. It's not very much to ask that some small little set-aside areas, especially, you know, when you're on that corridor, you're bordered between the Oaks Bottom on one side and then the channel and then the island. And that's just a comment for me, and I think it's just something important the city, you know, we can do for the city. And the other thing is, I want to just express my thanks to Bob for all the work you've done over the years, you know, with Audubon and that. And I just, I just really appreciate it of you and people like you and the work you do. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling. Yes, every time I see a bald eagle in Oaks Bottom, I think of you and my calc. So appreciate that work a lot. I want to let people know that coming up on KBU this morning at 9 on Alternative Radio, author and independent political analysis Michael Parenti speaks on the hypocrisies of capitalism. At 10 on Air Cascadia, Chris Andre interviews environmental activist Vandana Shiva, who spoke at the recent Organicology conference in Portland. Sorry about that. And it's something about organic, I guess, organicness conference. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an Iraq veteran talks about why he went AWOL and now plans to march on the Pentagon, and more on the police killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland. And 11 on the food show, hear Potato Talk featuring vegan potato recipes, a visit to an incredible local garden at Roosevelt High, and where growing food unifies and nurtures youth, and interviews with an heirloom potato breeder and organic potato farmer. And that's all coming up in KBU this morning and throughout the day. Right now we're talking with Bob Salinger, who's the Urban Conservation Director of the Portland Audubon Society. And we've been talking about protecting the Holgate Channel, which runs between Ross Island and the east bank of the Willamette River, and protecting it from the noise and wakes and disruption of high-speed boats, and keep creating a haven for paddlers, kayakers, bird watchers, and birds.
Right.
Beaver and whoever else lives there. And I think maybe a handful of coyote are maybe down there now, too. But let's talk now about, speaking of wildlife, I was looking at some pictures on your website of what lives on West Hayden Island, which is, if you go down to where Jansen Beach is and all that stuff, and you continue west, suddenly it changes drastically. And what do you see?
Well, West Hayden Island is an amazing place. And when people think of Hayden Island or Jansen Beach, they tend to think of shopping malls and car lots and marinas, because the East End is incredibly heavily developed. In fact, it's one of the most poorly developed areas of our city. It really was done in a very ecologically insensitive way. But more than half the island is actually natural areas, and people don't even realize that it exists. There's an 826-acre natural area on the west end of Hayden Island that the Port of Portland has owned since 1994, and they have up no trespassing signs and a fence, so you really can't go there, at least you can't go there illegally. But when people realize that this gigantic natural area exists, they're just shocked. And if you actually get out there, it is truly an amazing place. It's basically cottonwood bottomland forest, a cottonwood gallery forest. To give you an idea of how significant it is, between River Mile 12 and the Bonneville Dam, more than 100 miles of river, West Hayden Island represents 4% of the remaining intact cottonwood habitat. And this was once the most dominant habitat on the lower Columbia, but today we've decimated it. There's very few large intact stands, and Hayden Island represents about 4% of what's left. There are 39 acres of wetlands out there.
There are more than 100 different species that have been identified out there. There are it's designated critical habitat for listed salmon and steelhead. Just an amazing place. And the Port of Portland would essentially like to turn it into parking lots. They are proposing to build marine terminals out there. And basically, if you've been out to T6 and you've seen those miles and miles of parking lots, that's kind of what they're proposing. And they've been trying to do this since 1994. We've been fighting the port and PGE, which owned it before the port, for the better part of three decades on this. And right now there's a proposal to annex it, bring it into the city of Portland, and rezone it to allow for marine industrial development.
So what are you doing to preserve what's there and maybe preserve it in perpetuity?
Well, it's interesting. This isn't the first time we've been here. They tried to do this back in 1998, 99, 2000. They went through a very, very expensive, laborious public process, and eventually they have had to withdraw their application. They gave up, and they put the island into Marine Industrial Reserve. And I worked on that process back then. And what we found out when we really started to analyze the basis for their proposal was that it really didn't have any merit. First of all, it was incredibly ecologically destructive, one of the worst planned developments I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot of bad development, but this one was just unbelievably ecologically insensitive. Secondly, the mitigation that we're going to do, that they're proposing to do, turned out not to be places they could actually do it. And we told them that during the process, but they denied it. Third, we found out that there were alternative sites. And one of the big issues we have with this development is that we have ports up and down the Columbia Corridor competing with each other, duplicating each other. It's inefficient. It doesn't make maximum use of the existing industrial land base. And in 1999, not just Audubon Society of Portland, but also the Business Journal of Portland, not your typical left-wing newspaper.
Environmental tree huggers.
both were pushing the ports of Portland and Vancouver to work together to maximize their industrial land base and reduce duplication. The Business Journal of Portland did front page article after front page article and editorial after editorial calling on the port to work with the port of Vancouver. At first, the two ports adamantly denied that there was opportunity, but when they pulled the plug on this process back in 2000, they admitted that, in fact, that they weren't collaborating, they weren't maximizing their land base, and that they needed to go back and review whether there were better opportunities. Notably, conservationists on both sides of the river, both in Vancouver and in Portland, were arguing to protect West Haddon Island and to make better use of the Port of Vancouver lands. So it really is a unique resource. The last thing is that it's a big question is whether this is even needed. The Port of Portland insists that it's needed, that they will run out of developable land for marine industrial terminals in the near future. But in fact, if you go back to the 1990s, they were saying they were going to need it by the around 2000, 2002. In 2000, they postponed it, said they probably wouldn't need it till 2008, 2010. Today, they still can't tell you when they're going to need it or what they're going to build out there, but they tell you that we do have to annex it and rezone it to allow it to happen. They were predicting that they would have about a 48% increase in marine cargo between 1996 and 2006, and that was a primary basis for arguing for this thing. Again, a 48% increase between 1996 and 2006. In fact, they had a 13% increase, less than a third of what they were predicting. And as we're seeing today, some of their major cargo shippers like K-Lines are pulling out. Really the question as to whether this should ever occur at all anywhere is relevant here, but we certainly believe it shouldn't happen on Haddon Island.
Well, I'm talking with Bob Salinger, Urban Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society. We've been talking about protecting some very amazing natural spaces within, well, one within Portland city limits, one just on the outside of Portland, but very close by, and two areas that actually have been incredibly industrialized over the last 100 years, and the importance of renaturalizing marine areas that don't need to be industrialized anymore, or at least in some eyes, or areas that could be protected from encroachment of industrialization. And we got a few more minutes if you want to join the conversation. The number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 11 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. April's on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in and say that I'm really enjoying this show about preserving natural areas in the city. I think that connections between people and nature have been lost, and we really need those. So I really want to thank you both for talking about the connections and preserving what we have both in the city and just outside the city. And I'd also like to let everyone know that on Saturday the 21st, which is this Saturday, Radical Women is having a reproductive rights uprising. It's a panel and discussion about triumphs and lessons from Australia to Nicaragua. And for more information, people could call 503-240-4462. The event starts at 7 in the evening, and it's at the Bread and Roses Center. There will be a buffet at 6 o'clock for a donation of $8, but the panel and the discussion afterwards are totally free. And the Bread and Roses Center is at 819 North Killingsworth.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And I'm talking with Bob Salinger, and we're talking about preserving natural areas. And I just as a throw out, when people call, we really do like to stay on subject. And so if you have an announcement you want to make about an event that really has nothing to do with what we're talking about, I would prefer you call a show that it's more relevant for, or get the event listed on the community calendar. But it is really not something that we it kind of interrupts the flow of what we're talking about.
But I want to highlight something that the caller said at the beginning of the call, which is that people-nature connection. And, you know, Jansen Beach, Hayden Island, actually is one of the worst natured areas of our city. It's one of the most park-deficient areas of our city. And it's very sad. You know, people come across the border from Washington, and the first thing they see is an example of really, really bad ecological insensitive development.
Here we are in Oregon, the ecological haven, right?
Yep. And that and the Hooters sign as you go down I-5. And, you know, one of the things that's really appealing, I think, about protecting West Hayden Island is you could take this very degraded landscape and restore West Hayden Island and have really a world-class natural area, another world-class natural area inside of an urban ecosystem. You know, there's amazing opportunities to go out there and put in some trails and allow people to have a really amazing park. I mean, this is a park on the scale of Tryon Creek State Park, to give you an idea of how big it is. So really an incredible opportunity out there. And one of the things we don't talk a lot about, you know, the port will talk about the value of marine industrial development. We don't talk about the ecosystem services that a place like West Hayden Island provides for fish, for wildlife, for carbon sequestration. If we cut down the trees on West Hayden Island, no matter how many trees we plant in the city of Portland over the next decade or two, we'll have a net deficit. There's no way we can make up replacing 800 acres of trees in a place like West Hayden Island. It's all floodplain. In 1996, it was underwater. You couldn't have found it. You could have boated over the top of it. And yet we're talking about putting hundreds of acres of impervious surface out there. There are pollution issues. A significant portion of the diesel emissions in the region come from ships that are idling in port. We've now been inflicting that on the citizens that live out on Hayden Island. So there's huge impacts from this thing above and beyond wildlife and just loss of nature. There are real ecosystem services out there. And you know, lastly, again, I would point out that it is critical habitat for salmon and steelhead. And this is the most degraded part of the Columbia Corridor system and the Willamette system. And so for fish using the Willamette River and the Columbia River, this area of North Portland Harbor and the Columbia River as it passes through Portland and Vancouver really are the worst part of that gauntlet that they have to survive. And for juvenile salmon, shallow water habitat is absolutely critical. When they're going downstream to the ocean, having these areas really about every quarter of a mile apart where they can stop and rest and feed and be safe from predators is absolutely critical. We have very few of them left. We tend to talk about things like Hayden Island in terms of balance. When the port talks about it, they talk about a balanced solution. And when they do that, they look at the parcel only. They say, well, it's 800 acres. We'll take 600 acres. We'll leave you two, and everyone should be happy. What we need is a more macro view. If you look at a satellite photograph of Portland and Vancouver, look at it from space, what you see is that the vast majority of the landscape is developed. Half of Hayden Island is developed already. Most of the banks are developed. There's very few spots of green left, and I would argue that we already have an ecosystem that's out of balance, and we need to protect and perhaps restore even more.
I think that gets us back to Oaks Bottom and Ross Island again, looking at, I mean, you go from Hayden Island and the port all the way down or up the Willamette River, and you it, it isn't until you get to Ross Island that you get to a semblance of nature again.
Exactly.
And that I think the lessons that can be learned from looking at the restoration that's been going on in Oaks Bottom and the restoration you're talking about that'll happen at Ross Island is an example of what I would like to see happen at the mouth of the Willamette River. And, I mean, that's happened to some degree with Smith and Bybee Lakes, but it'd be very exciting to have Hayden Island become actually part of the Smith and Bybee Lakes complex as opposed to it being part of the Jansen Beach complex.
Exactly. You know, I mean, Hayden Island, study after study has identified two primary reasons for it being so ecologically valuable. The first is its size. So, you know, developing the vast portions of it and leaving remnant habitat will really destroy the primary value. The second thing is its location, because it provides connectivity between some of these remnant sites that we have, places like Smith and Bybee Lake that you just referenced, Vancouver Lake Lowlands, Sovie Island, the Sandy River Delta. This really sits in the middle of that. And so when you take this away, you undermine the integrity of all these other sites that remain around it as well. So the impacts go beyond the site itself.
I'm talking with Bob Salinger, who's the Urban Conservation Director of Portland Audubon Society. We're just about running out of time, but I'm going to take one more phone call. We got Thatcher on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I appreciate the show, and I'm enjoying it. And I would add, I just moved recently to near Oaks Bottom, and having moved from Longview, Washington, I would just, to put it in perspective, I don't think Oregon's doing so bad compared to some of the industrial areas of Washington, and Collins County is hurting for pollution in some areas. My question concerns, I've really been enjoying the Springwater Corridor by bicycle, but I was surprised that it stops after the Sellwood Bridge at Tacoma. Are you guys aware of any plans to continue that? Because being from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I'm familiar with the ways in which pedestrian and bicycle spaces can sort of support investments in ecological areas such as Oaks Bottom and the riverine communities.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for calling.
There's definitely work going on at Portland Parks to continue the Springwater Corridor. And really, you know, there's some amazing work going on at Metro as well, a new initiative over there called Connecting Green that's looking at the entire regional trail system, because we have a lot of really great incomplete trails that historically have competed with each other for funding. And, and the goal that Metro is pursuing now is to get all those folks together and put together some really big packages that will allow all those trails to rise together. And it's really exciting work, because I think for the first time you have this massive trails community, this very, very powerful group coming together and working together to go after some big funding pots that allow all these trails, not just the Springwater Corridor, to come to completion over time. And there's really a great vision out there that not only sees this interconnected system of trails within the metropolitan region, but also connecting up to Mount Hood, for example, and the idea that you could start at Pioneer Square, head eastward, ride up to Timberline Lodge and head south and go to Mexico on the Pacific Crest Trail. It's just a great vision.
But not on your bicycle.
Not on your bicycle. You got to get off your bike and hike at that point.
Well, I've been talking with Bob Salinger, who is the Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society. Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure you'll be back again soon. They're saving wildlife and wildlife habitat in the city of Portland. You've been listening to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Well, thank you for listening. We're going to go with some music by Padam Padam. Be back next week, and we'll probably be talking about the economy once more. Thank you.
Greetings, Cascadia. My name is Steve, and this is the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, March 18th, 2009. Southeast Precinct residents interested in solving the homelessness crisis can gather to share resources and ideas tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m. at a meeting of the Community Policing Committee for the Central East Side Industrial Council. This meeting takes place early in the day every third Thursday at the East Bank Saloon and Restaurant, 727 Southeast Grand. The purpose of the meeting is to find humanitarian, safe, and effective ways to deal with transients, graffiti, vandalism, and other problems that plague living life in the streets of Portland. Women of color, come join the Sister Circle every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the PSU Women's Resource Center. This is a Women of Color success group presented by the PSU chapter of the NAACP, the Black Cultural Affairs Board, and the PSU Women's Resource Center itself. This series ends tonight, March 18th, so come and get it while you can. The Habitat for Humanity Women Build Committee meets tonight, the third Wednesday, from 6 until 7 p.m. at the Portland Habitat Office, 1478 Northeast Killingsworth. The Women Build Committee works on all aspects of the build, which includes the planning process, recruiting and managing volunteers, organizing events, and raising money. If you are attending the meeting for the first time, please contact the Habitat Office to confirm meeting times and location. That's 503-287-9529. This has been the KBOO Community Calendar for Wednesday, March 18th, 2009. Thanks for listening. If you support full-strength, volunteer-powered, homegrown community radio, then browse on over to www.kboo.fm and click Join Now.
And you are listening to KBOO in Portland, and it is 1 minute past 9 a.m. Coming right up, Alternative Radio, with author and independent political analyst Michael Parenti. He speaks on the hypocrisies of capitalism. At 10 on Air Cascadia, Chris Andre interviews environmental activist Vandana Shiva, who spoke at the recent Organicology Conference in Portland. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an Iraq veteran talks about why he went AWOL and now plans to march on the Pentagon, and more on the police killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland. And at 11 on the Food Show, hear Potato Talk featuring vegan potato recipes, a visit to an incredible local garden at Roosevelt High, where growing food unifies and nurtures youth, and interviews with an heirloom potato breeder and an organic potato farmer. And so now let's go to Alternative Radio.
So the people who are now, who have always been scolding us for running to the government for a handout, are themselves running to the government for a bailout. Estimated $2 trillion the Federal Reserve, aside from the TARP money that the Federal Reserve has been giving out. Most of the money, the hundreds of billions, gone to the banks. The banks have refused to say what they're doing with the money. This is what Bank of New York Mellon, quote, "We're choosing not to disclose that," when they were asked, "How are you spending all this money? Where's it going?" JP Morgan Chase, "We have not disclosed that to the public. We're declining to."
That's Michael Parenti, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Michael Parenti on the hypocrisies of capitalism. The Newsweek cover declares, "We are all socialists now." Some people have a different take on it. Paul Krugman, commenting on the bailout of banks and the giant insurance company AIG, says it's a classic example of what he calls lemon socialism. That is, taxpayers bear the cost if things go wrong, but stockholders and executives get the benefits if things go right. Krugman, a Nobel Prize winner, is describing our economic system as it really is, not the fantasy tale spun for mass consumption by Alan Greenspan and his disciples. One salient aspect of the economic collapse is the focus on rotten apples, like Bernard Madoff and Robert Allen Stanford. They are easy pickings. We can all be virtuous in denouncing them as cheats and swindlers. But what escapes scrutiny and discussion is the barrel itself, and that is the capitalist system. Michael Parenti is one of this country's foremost independent political analysts. He's taught at major colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. He's the author of numerous books, including the classic Democracy for the Few, as well as the highly acclaimed The Assassination of Julius Caesar. His latest book is Contrary Notions. Michael Parenti spoke at the Loudoun Nelson Community Center in Santa Cruz, California, in a benefit for Free Radio Santa Cruz in February 2009.
Throughout history, wealth and poverty have existed side by side, and they're often treated as if it was an unfortunate juxtaposition. Isn't that a shame? So much wealth here for the few, and then so much poverty for these other people. What a shame, isn't that? But it's more than just an unfortunate juxtaposition. In fact, they always existed so closely because there's a causal link between the two. The way you get a small group of people to be very rich is by getting a lot of other people to work very hard, very long, and consume relatively little themselves, and have the rest expropriated by the favored few. That's how you do it. The goal is to get those who toil to create more value than they consume. That surplus value, that wealth, is accumulated by the slave owner, the feudal lord, or the private capitalist investor at different times in history. Let's take the first one, the slave owner. The first 8 or 9 presidents of the United States, 7 of them were slave owners. I think the first 8 were. Well, anyway, number 4 is the one I want to talk about. He was called the father of the American Constitution. His name was James Madison. There are 3 things I think you should know about founding father James Madison. 1, he was a slaveholder. 2, he was quite rich. And 3, there's a relationship between his being a slaveholder and being quite rich. 1 and 2 equals 3, actually. Madison once told a visitor to his estate that he made $257 a year off the labor of every slave he owned. And he spent only $12 or $13 a year to feed and sustain every slave. You see, slavery, contrary to a mythology that developed among some historians years later, slavery was very profitable. I mean, you make very good money on slave labor. Because the slave worked from not dawn to dusk. He worked from the crack of dawn well into the night. After nightfall came, he was back on the plantation mending fences and digging ditches and repairing things and preparing whatever else, taking care of livestock. So it was very profitable. That's why the slaveholders did it. They didn't do it because it was unprofitable. They didn't do it because they wanted to take care of these poor, sweet people with their sweet, soft singing. They did it to make money, to make extract from the slaves, to make money. And you'd go all through the South, and there were all sorts of people who were looking to own a slave. And they didn't want to own a slave because it was just the thing to do, or because they got a certain status out of it, because they wanted to make money off this other person's labor. And that's why they defended their institution with the utmost ferocity. And that's why they saw abolitionism to be nothing more than thievery, a stealing of what was rightfully theirs, their wealth. And I said to you, I said that it cost Madison $12 to $13 to feed and sustain each slave. Now, that's a false statement, isn't it? That's the slaveholder's talk. Because Madison didn't feed and sustain the slaves. The slaves fed and sustained Madison. And indeed, in the style to which he was accustomed. Now, great wealth creates poverty. That's what I'm saying. The poverty of those slaves who had nothing, not even command over their own lives and personalities in any way, the poverty created this enormous wealth. And as wealth has grown, so has poverty. The number of people in the world living in poverty today is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. So poverty is spreading, while wealth accumulates in record abundance in concentrations that are enormous. I'll say a little more about that in a minute. The accepted ideology of capitalism says that that isn't really so, that you're being zero sum, you know, more for me is less for you. That's very simplistic. By the way, that's my position, that so-called I believe that's exactly true. I mean, there are certain instances where you could say, you know, a boss changes everything into computers and gets rid of all the hand files and such, so he wipes out half his administrative staff, and now the productivity of the other half is three times what the larger workforce was. And being three times larger, and because you need a little more schooling, he might have given you a little more of a raise, too. So you do share a little bit in the increase in productivity. Usually that's not true. The statistics don't show that. I'll show you. But, I mean, there are examples of that sort of thing. But generally, it is zero sum. We hear this told to us, a rising tide lifts all boats. You've heard that, right? No, today a rising tide lifts all yachts. That's the real phrase, you should say. A rising tide drowns many people. That's what, because there are a lot of people who are just barely hanging on or drowning. It is zero sum. The more for the landlords, the less there is for the renters. In New York City, when the landlords, after spending millions of dollars, got rent control rolled back in an effective way, that changed the lives of any all sorts of New Yorkers. I'm originally a New Yorker. You probably guess just hearing me talk, you got a problem with that. So, but there were people who used to go on vacation. No more vacation, because where's the money going? The money's going to the 25% hike in their rent. So there's more for the landlord and there's less for the tenant. It stands to reason. More for the owners means less for the workers. More for the corporate giveaways means less money for the taxpayers, for human services and all. It actually means more taxes for us, more costs. And conversely, it works the other way too. More for the workers means less for the owners. If I, as an owner, every dollar that I spend on stupid things like wages and health benefits and occupational safety and environmental protection and paid vacations, and every dollar I got to spend on stupid things like that is one less dollar I can put in my pocket. So you bet it's zero sum. And the plutocratic class, the plutocracy, by plutocracy we mean rule by the wealthy few. The plutocrats oppose democracy. That's another claim, that capitalism brings democracy. But you find all throughout history, the plutocrats opposed every democratic reform. Abolition of property qualifications, they opposed it. Extension of the suffrage to newly arrived immigrants, they opposed it. Literacy tests that would limit and rule out people from voting with strict registration requirements and such, they supported that and pushed that and pushed that. Every single thing, collective bargaining so that people would have a chance to make a decent wage, they opposed it. They opposed all of those things. They opposed the empowerment of ordinary working people, and that meant they opposed, I don't want to say enrichment, but what would be the word? The betterment for ordinary working people. And to the extent that life in this country today is bearable, to the extent that it's bearable, under this relentless, rapacious plutocracy, it's because of the democratic gains we fought for and won. They never gave us a thing. We had to extract every single thing. People paid with their blood and their lives, people, many of whose names we don't even know, for the 8-hour day, for affordable medical care, public education, secure retirement pensions, decent disability insurance, occupational safety, effective labor unions, environmental protections. One could go on. All of them totally inadequate in this country right now. But to the extent that we have anything, it's been extracted, struggles from the grudging grip of this super rich class. The established ideology that we are taught also says that capitalism creates prosperity, not poverty. As I just said, you know, the rising tide, all the boats and all that. I mean, it takes a certain audacity to claim credit for the very thing that you try to undo and roll back. Look at North America and Western Europe, they would say. The capitalist countries are the prosperous ones. But that is a very selective view of capitalism. First of all, there are a lot of poor people in North America, struggling poor and working poor, people who have jobs and still are poor. My argument is that class wealth creates poverty, as I was just saying, and I'll prove it to you in 10 seconds. As against the lifetime of propaganda and ideology, you've had all that. Now, all those years we've been told that. Now you give me 10 seconds. Here's how it goes. Most of the world is capitalist, and most of the world is poor. Most of the world is getting more capitalist, and with privatizations and free trade and takeovers and such, and most of the world is getting poorer. So capitalism works, you say? Capitalism brings prosperity? It does. It works best, but for whom? It works much better in Indonesia than it does in Denmark. In Denmark, the capitalist has all sorts of restrictions. There are worker protections. There are problems. He's got to wider regulations about environment. There are human services. There are heavy taxes he's got to pay. In Indonesia, he's got none of that. There's none of that. There's no consumer protections. There's no minimum wages. And so if a worker gets mangled, you just toss him aside and put another worker in his place. That's where it works. Your investment in Indonesia is multiplied. For every dollar you invest there, you may get 12, 14 back, where in Denmark you may get 2 or 3 back, you see. So that's capitalism for you. It works best in countries like Indonesia, much of Africa, Nigeria, Liberia, Mexico, El Salvador, Haiti, capitalist Philippines, capitalist Thailand, and the like. Those are capitalist countries, and that's where you want to really be. If you were Nike, why do you close your factory in Ohio? Why do you go all the way across the world, that vast Pacific, into Indonesia, as a matter of fact? And you have to outsource all the materials. You've got to bring all the materials to Indonesia also. Because in Ohio, you are paying these people $12 an hour, plus benefits, plus this, plus that, plus this restriction, that requirement. In Indonesia, it doesn't matter. You can build it any way you want. There's no occupational safety to worry about. There's no toxicity to worry about. If a worker is poisoned, he's just tossed aside. And you pay them 18 cents an hour. 18 cents. So a pair of your Nike shoes would cost only $7. Even though you got to ship it all the way across the Pacific, it still comes to only $7. That doesn't mean you, the consumer, get a break on it. When they bring it back, they don't sell it to you any cheaper than they would have if it was made when it was made in Ohio. You think they went always over there to give you a break? They went always over there to widen their margin of profit and to exploit people and take advantage of a low market where the profit margins are high, the unions are weak or non-existent. So the third world is not underdeveloped. The third world is overexploited. The suppression of labor that goes on abroad also has a depressing and subverting effect on labor at home. So that by exporting that job from Ohio to Indonesia, you are depressing wages at home because, in effect, the Indonesian worker is competing with the American worker. Why don't we work for 18 cents an hour when Indonesians do? Is it because we are so more self-respecting? No. In fact, in America, we did work for 18 cents an hour or less back in 1900. I'll be talking about that in a minute. It's that we're now at a stage of historical struggle where we come to a better standard of living. What American labor is told is, look, you got the whole world now is competing. It's a one big global market, globalization we call it. So you got to tighten your belts and you got to really work harder and faster for less in this increasingly competitive global economy. Now the investors are never told to tighten their belts. U.S. national security states should stop suppressing labor abroad, should improve work and wage conditions abroad, lift them closer to our level, not lower us to theirs. In 1991, I called this whole process of rollback going on here as the third worldization of America. In fact, it's really now the third worldization of everywhere, including Europe. Of course, these kind of pressures and struggles going on in Western Europe, most notably, for instance, in Italy and France and places like that, and England, where the welfare state, much of it has been privatized and roll back also in our neighbor to the north in Canada. There's a rough but very real correlation between the condition of labor and the condition of democracy. In countries where labor is strong, such as the Scandinavian countries, for instance, personal rights are strong. Human services are good. In countries like those where unionization is very high in Scandinavian countries. In countries where unions have been destroyed and stamped out, so have civil liberties and human services, Guatemala, Haiti, El Salvador, etc. So the class struggle is a key component in the struggle for democracy itself. There still remains the time-honored view that America is a land of milk and honey, the promised land, what I call the prosperity myth. In fact, you know, there was an abundance, an extraordinary abundance of fertile lands on this continent that gave a rough and tough but decent existence to many homesteaders. But as late as 1900, the U.S. was a third world nation, half a century before the term was invented. It was, in 1900, a free market paradise. The free market was tried. It held sway, and the results were those of the free market. In country after country in the 1990s, Argentina, name the ones, that all went free market, IMF. What happened to them? You even had mainstream reporters saying, that system doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's terrible. It leads to such impoverishment and instability and the like. And that's when the free market ideologues come forward and say, that's because that's not really the free market. You see, it's a non-falsifiable position. You always fall back to an imaginary perfection, and you're comparing that to what? A very imperfect reality. And, of course, the imaginary perfection always comes off looking better. But in 1900, we did have the kind of country that reactionary Republicans and libertarians like Ron Paul dream about. We did try the free market. We had no government regulations or interference, certainly none that were enforced. The market ruled supreme. We had child labor, children working 12 and 14 hours a day. That was the free labor market. We had widespread poverty and underemployment. No pensions or minimum wage protections, no disability insurance, contaminated foods, even worse than today, regressive tax systems, even worse than today, no environmental protections, typhoid epidemics in cities like Philadelphia, Baltimore, the like, tuberculosis and other diseases of poverty were widespread. people who lived whole lives and never saw a doctor, or I mean, other than a quack who might come around or something like that, never saw a dentist. By the way, that's still true today in America. You know, there's no public dental insurance. There's only private dental insurance. So you have millions of people in America today. One third of the people over the age of 65 have no teeth. That means that when they got a problem and such, they planted or a crown or this or that, a filling, if it was really unsavable, they just had it yanked. And when one tooth is yanked, then another one, then another. And before you know it, that's what we got. So in a way, you see, we're moving back to that third world status that we were in 1900. That was a free market. No restrictions, no government regulations, no bureaucratic red tape. Let's move from 1900 to 1920. Now, by 1920, there was, in fact, the development of a mass consumption market in America. But there also was still mass poverty. I saw a quote by Congressman Fiorello LaGuardia in New York City talking about the conditions of misery in some of the slum tenements. He said, I couldn't believe what I saw. The conditions of hunger and overcrowding and just a really miseration. Mass immigrations from the 1870s to 1914 also piled in more layers of humanity into the urban slums. Cheap labor, hard labor. Then came the Great Depression, and things went from bad to worse. Now, the Great Depression, the crash of 1929, just didn't happen, you know. There have been things developing all along. There have been a real lag in consumption. There have been a tendency for inventories to be piling up. There had been depression in rural areas throughout America through the 1920s. Even though the urban areas, it was the jazz age and automobile was come in and the Ford model and all that sort of thing. In the rural areas, they were already experiencing that depression that was still to come. So you saw that kind of thing happening. I remember the Great Depression. I remember it lurking over the consciousness of my family. They always made references to the Depression. And I just knew that it was some disembodied kind of monster that lurked around somewhere in our neighborhood, if not in our house. Then came the New Deal with a series of progressive programs that did help to some degree. Public works, national parks, Social Security, collective bargaining, a real increase of many billions of dollars in wages through victories won through collective bargaining and unionization, which actually helped the economy, because every dollar I had to give to those workers, instead of me putting it in treasury notes or in building my mansion or whatever else, every dollar went and he could spend it on other things, and there was the multiplier effect, and the other people who sold that to him, and they had dollars and they would buy things and so forth. That's what Obama is talking about today with his stimulus package. There would be that what used to be called the Keynesian multiplier. Not that Keynes invented it. People knew about it before Keynes, but he made a big deal about it. That you get some money out there, you create jobs. Those people, by spending money, create more jobs. Just as the cycle is going the other way right now. You're laying off people. They stop buying less. The other people start selling less. They have to lay off their workers. And you go into a downward spiral. Okay. Now, we all know that the New Deal never really pulled the nation out of the Depression. It didn't spend enough. Roosevelt, in 1938, decides to balance the budget, increase taxes, just these contracting things, the last thing that the economy needed there, and plunged us back into a recession. But then came World War II, and the government was ready, and so was corporate America, ready to spend at a level to kill people, what it would not do to feed people. Couldn't spend at that level to feed people, but when it came to killing people, they went all out into it and really went gung-ho with the whole thing. Now, World War II helps explain that period from 1946, after the war, ended in 45, 1946 to about 1980, which is known as the Great Prosperity. When we always talk about America as being a great prosperous country, that's the period we really mean, 1946 to 1980. What you had happen in World War II was all sorts of people who would have gratefully have lined up for a job for $25 a week or $30 a week, where now, I remember my Uncle Nick, he worked in a defense plant. Instead of, he used to be an auto mechanic, made that kind of money, just barely made a living. He went into a defense plant, and with overtime and everything else, he was making $100, $120 a week. You have no idea what in 1942, 43, 44, for working class Italian American family in New York, what $120 a week was. I mean, that was money. And people were making very good money suddenly. Women who had never even knew they could be employable were suddenly now becoming Rosie the Riveters and getting out there and getting these jobs of all sorts. And so there was a lot of money. And I used to hear from my uncles and my dad all saying, you know, after this war is over, there's going to be a depression again. It'll all come back. The depression will be here. And they anticipated that this war and the spending would just not be enough. Well, what happened when the war ended was that there was an enormous backlog of consumer demand, and there was an enormous backlog of money. That people made more money, but there was nothing to spend it on. Everything was rationed. You couldn't buy a new car. You couldn't buy cars. All the auto factories were making tanks and planes. You couldn't buy a refrigerator. You couldn't buy this or that, the other thing. So there was this sudden backlog. And instead of the crash coming, instead of a depression coming, there was this immense amounts of money suddenly pouring in. Suddenly, Levittown was being built and little ticky-tack houses, and people actually had enough money to put a down payment down on houses. And there was a prosperity that came from the earnings of war among the working class itself, with this backlog of unsatisfied consumer desires.
You're listening to Michael Parenti on the Hypocrisies of Capitalism. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Another factor that led to this prosperity was a remarkable piece of legislation. Its nickname was the GI Bill of Rights, which actually, the imagination in that day was still about World War I. I remember seeing that in newspapers too, cartoons, or illustrations, photos of boys who came home from World War I and they ended up selling apples in the street. This became an iconic symbol. Are they going to be selling apples in the street with a little stand, you know, 5 cents apples? This was like, you know, this was the image of how someone is hit bottom. So instead, Congress, of course, in gratitude to all these men and a few women too, all of them going to war for us and saving us from the Axis powers, this GI Bill was passed. And it was really a remarkable piece of legislation because about 9 to 10 million returning veterans went off to school. These were people who had never dreamed of even, some of them had even finishing high school, were now finishing high school, going to college, and getting full-time stipends and getting their tuition paid and pursuing careers, advanced education, expanding the production, productivity, and skills and opportunities of an economy as never before. When you invest, it really is true, when you invest in people and their capacities, it's a good way of investing in your economy, too. So billions more were poured into the economy. So that was the second big factor that led to this reality of prosperity. Well, you can say, well, we have a GI Bill of Rights right now. It's that law is still in operation. Why isn't it having such a salutary effect. The GI Bill today is a pale shadow of what it was in 1945, 47, 48, 50. When I was in college, the early 50s, we still had GIs coming back, going on the GI Bill to college. Today, even with the GI Bill, it doesn't pay full stipend. It doesn't pay full tuition. Veterans discover that they go back to school and they've got to get a part-time job, sometimes two jobs. They find they have to still also get student loans. A lot of them get disgusted and give up. And these were often young men and women who went into the Army in the first place in the hope of getting an affordable college education later on. So it doesn't work today. They have ground away and gnawed away at it and have diluted and undermined it, as they've done with so many other New Deal and Square Deal and Fair Deal and all the other gains that were made in the 60s and 70s. A third factor for this prosperity was the war itself, in that it also created, at public cost and at a national debt, a huge reserve of profits and investment funds within the plutocracy. Now, the United States was already the world's leading manufacturing power by 1890. When William McKinley was president, the U.S. was already manufacturing more than any other country in the world. But after World War II, the United States was the only manufacturing base that was still perfectly intact, and actually bigger and more vigorous than ever. So it took over more and more markets, even as European production was in shambles at the time. So war, you know, is a form of creative destruction for capitalist reinvestment. A fourth factor for prosperity was the Cold War, because the Cold War, while there was a great dismantling of military spending, you would no longer keep 15 million people in the armed services. They were all deployed and such. But you still had a very big military budget, and you built up a military economy, and with all sorts of suppliers and subsidiaries and whatever else, spending the taxpayers' money and maintaining a certain level of investment and income and profit. So those things taken together gave us this prosperity. And in those years, 46 to say 80, working people were working 8-hour days. They had job security and seniority, paid vacations, time and a half overtime, company medical insurance, adequate retirement pensions, and all that. Many of them lived in decent housing and even could pay a mortgage on a home of their own, while their kids went to public school and even to public universities that cost relatively little. So millions of people who never dreamed of it were now living a middle-class lifestyle, had a car and a house they were paying for and all that. And that was the big American dream. And there was a whole literature, a whole Hollywood set of films. Everybody in Hollywood lived in that kind of home. Nobody lived in a crowded tenement anymore and all that. And the rest of the world saw this, and the rest of the world was convinced, as I say, America was the land of milk and honey, where everybody was doing well. One group that was convinced of this prosperity was the plutocrats themselves. And it was interesting, in 1978 you had a group of, they weren't Bilderberg and they weren't maybe Knickerbocker Club. I got the quote somewhere, and I thought I had it here, but I don't. People who said, what's going on in this country? More and more concessions to the working populace. This is going to become a social democracy. I mean, they actually use that term. We are developing into a social democracy. We've got to stop this sort of thing. And by social democracy, they meant a Denmark or a Sweden or a Finland. Paul Volcker, chair of the Federal Reserve in 1980, quote, the standard of living of the average American has to decline. It was just getting too much. The plutocracy doesn't want to face a self-confident, well-educated populace that has a high sense of entitlement. That's not the kind of... They want a population that's hungry, that's desperate, the more hungry you are, the more desperate you are, the harder you will work for less and less. That's how we can get America back to being 1900, get it back to being Indonesia. Now notice what Volcker said, the standard of living of the average American has to decline, not his standard of living. He's not an average American. And he didn't miss one filet mignon dinner from all this cutbacks at all. And decline it has, starting really in earnest with the advent of the Reagan administration in 1981. There was an increase in poverty and homelessness, substandard housing and schools, longer work days with no overtime pay, time and a half time and a half for no pay. People are forced to work extra hours and not get paid anything more for it. A growing tax burden increasingly shifted onto the backs of lower income strata, fewer if any vacation days, inadequate health care, millions more without affordable health insurance or with health insurance that doesn't really insure, privatization of public services, and one could go on, cutting disability assistance, cutting family support, undermining environmental protections, and the like. And yet all we ever heard was that the economy was sound, that it was doing well. Just a few months ago, you had George Bush giving talks about how our economy is basically sound. The joker word there is basically. If you happen to be in the unbasic parts of it, you're really getting it hit. I remember hearing an NPR station that said, NPR news analyst, he said, if you remove food, fuel, and housing from the equation, inflation hasn't been all that bad. Isn't that great? That's interesting. If you remove a few more things, it disappears altogether, inflation, doesn't it? But that's an interesting mode of analysis, isn't it, to do that? I mean, can you apply that to a lot of other things? You say, if you don't count the last 15 years, none of us has aged all that much, right? It's marvelous. It's a real feel-good way of looking at things, I would say. In 2007, four American workers were producing what it had taken five of them to produce in 2006. So in other words, productivity had advanced by 20%. But wages didn't advance by 20% or even 5% or 10%. Wages were held flat. By 2005, the hourly wages of average workers was 11% lower than they had been in 1973, adjusted for inflation, despite this rise in worker productivity. Big executives, corporate executives, by contrast, they're at the average increase in their income was 30% in 2004 alone, in 1 year alone, 30% increase in a survey done of the 2,000 largest companies. Medium household income has fallen unprecedented 5 years in a row. It's actually, that was 2001 to 2005. These are old statistics. It's really more like 7 or 8 years in a row now. It'd be even a lot lower if you didn't count households. But you see, what often happens in the household is 10 years ago, one person was working, now two or maybe three. The son or daughter doesn't leave and stays at home to be able to live at an affordable rent or rent-free or whatever, and also works. Holly Sklar, she says, she talked and she said this, we are breaking records. She said this in January 2006. We're breaking records we don't want to break. Record numbers of Americans have no health insurance. The share of national income going to wages and salaries is the lowest since 1929. Did you get that? Of the gross national income, the share that goes to wages and salaries, lowest since 29. The rest of it is going off to bonuses, fees, profits, and the like. A Republican Congress in 2005 voted the biggest cut in history to the student loan program at a time when college was more expensive than ever. Public college tuitions have risen even faster than private tuition, about 55% in one decade. which is a form of privatization of public education. You keep it as a public institution, you just keep charging tuitions and the like. Well, you get the picture. The infrastructure built by earlier generations has eroded greatly, undermining the economy as well as public health and safety. Now, these are all data from well before, I mean, these notes, too, are from well before the crises of this October. But many of us were saying this. Many of us were saying, we disagree with President Bush. The economy isn't in such good hands. It's not going well. There's a function of government that's often not mentioned, and it consists of preventing the capitalist system from devouring itself. That is, the function of the capitalist state, the function of the state is to protect property from those who have not property. That's what Marx wasn't the first to say that. Adam Smith said that. John Locke said that. Thomas Hobbes said that. James Madison said that. I can give you the quotes. I got them in my various writings. They say again and again, it's the function of the state is to protect those who have property from those who don't have it. But I argue there's another function. The function of the capitalist state is to protect capitalism from the capitalists. As Marx said, he said, one capitalist will kill many capitalists. In other words, he's saying there's a war here that goes on, really. One of the problems in the capitalist system is that it has a tendency to self-destruct. Marx gave that core contradiction, which is the tendency toward overproduction and market crises. An economy that's dedicated to making workers produce more and more for less and less is always in danger of a crash. If you want to maximize profits, you want to suppress wages, because wages cut into profits. That's what you want to do. So wages have to be kept down. But someone has to buy the goods and services being produced. And for that, wages must be kept up. And so there's a chronic tendency, and we're seeing that today, toward overproduction of private sector goods and services and underconsumption of necessities by the working populace. In addition, there's also the destruction that comes from the money players themselves. Many of them, instead of worrying about producing goods and services, will just tap into money streams or will pilfer their own companies. We saw the most dramatic case of that just a few years ago, right, with Ken Lay and Enron, right, thanks. I mean, Enron was a viable, healthy corporation. Well, after Ken Lay was finished with it, having stolen or just about what's the term I'm looking for? Mousetrap play in football is called. You just sucker in all the people and then you whack them with it. He brings the price of the value of this stock up high, sells it high, prohibits all the workers, requires them to buy stock with each payment, prohibits them from selling, and then they're stuck with stock that proves to be totally inflated and totally almost worthless. So you had about 5,000 people lost their jobs at Enron and lost their life savings because of Ken Lay. So this is a plunderer. This was, and Andrew Fastow and the whole bunch of others from Adelphi and Harkin and WorldCom and about a dozen other companies, these inside players. Well, most of these thieves were caught and convicted. Doesn't this show that capitalism is a self-correcting system? Well, no, not really, because the prosecution was a product of democracy's accountability and transparency, not capitalism. The push to get at those guys came from the democracy, not from the plutocracy. There's nobody, there was nobody up in the plutocracy who was demanding that Ken Lay be thrown in jail. Name one Fortune 500 CEO who came out and said, this is a disgrace. This is terrible. He should be shot or he should be jailed or whatever else. They didn't say anything like that. Capitalism is an amoral system. It has no goods or bads. It has no morality. It has only one stricture, only one rule. Caveat emptor. The buyer beware. You take your chances and that's that. Now, in the meltdown we've had in the last few months of the economy, what you've had are these mounting financial surpluses that created a problem for the money class. There were not enough opportunities to invest. But there were not enough opportunities to invest because there were not enough people to buy. It was not just a crisis in investment. It was a crisis in wages. And that's what we're seeing today. In other words, you want to say, are these evils systemic or are they due to vicious perpetrators and personalities like Ken Lay and Bernard Madoff? I would say these two things are not mutually exclusive. That if the system brings forth and brings to the fore such perpetrators and greatly rewards them, capitalism breeds the venal perpetrator and rewards the most unscrupulous among them. So the crimes and the crises that we're facing are not irrational departures from a rational system, but the converse. They're the rational outcomes of a basically irrational and amoral system. And worse still, the multi-trillion dollar bailouts that are happening are themselves being turned into an opportunity for pillage. Not only does the state fail to regulate, it itself becomes a source of plunder, pulling out these vast sums that we're all going to have to pay for later on, and leaving the taxpayers to bleed. And I wish people would stop saying our children and grandchildren. And this is going to affect our children and grandchildren. I wish they would stop saying that. I know it's a heart-tugging expression. When you stop saying our grandchildren, and if we don't, the environment, what do you mean your grandchildren? You're talking to 20-year-olds. They won't have grandchildren for maybe 40 years from now. It's happening right now. It's the things that we're paying and bleeding right now. The thing is falling apart right now. So the people who have always been scolding us for running to the government for a handout are themselves running to the government for a bailout. Estimated $2 trillion the Federal Reserve, aside from the TARP money that the Federal Reserve has been giving out. Most of the money, the hundreds of billions, gone to the banks. The banks have refused to say what they're doing with the money. This is what Bank of New York Mellon, quote, "We're choosing not to disclose that." When they were asked, how are you spending all this money? Where's it going? J.P. Morgan Chase, we have not disclosed that to the public. We're declining to. I mean, the arrogant, overweening, I have a friend, Manny Gonzalez. He says, I have two solutions for this present crisis. One has to do with, a lot of spending and stimulus packages and subsidies and such. And the second plan has to do with guillotines, which I think is a great idea. I'm for the guillotines myself. Well, let me stop here and let me just say that I want to make one conclusion, ideological one, that the conservative ideologues convince the public that government just doesn't work, and yet they always expect the government to pull us out of the jams that they create, you see. I want to point out that government does work. Consider something like occupational safety. Every year, about 23,000 people are killed on the job. That's a terrible amount. But you know, back in 1940, every year, 45,000 people were killed on the job. And that was with a workforce that was about half the size of today's workforce. It's true there were more industrial jobs too, but the point is, as inadequate as OSHA is, it has cut down. You don't see the things that government accomplishes in many cases, because what government does is it avoids certain things. I mean, if you have good traffic lanes and good lights and such, you don't see the accidents that don't take place there. You see. And so it is with these other things. Social Security works. It's inadequate. Nobody can really live completely on just Social Security. But it's the most effective anti-poverty program in U.S. history. And a check, and everybody gets their check every month. Medicare works. It has problems and such. and it's been sabotaged in the eight Bush years we've had here. Veterans Administration works. It has had problems, too. But all these three programs, they have low administrative costs. They're comprehensive. They've been beneficial to millions of people. They're affordable. They work better. They don't cost that much, really, for what they're doing. But there's no profits to the private sector. There's nobody in the plutocracy who's making money off them. And that's why they are constantly under siege.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Michael Parenti on the hypocrisies of capitalism. He spoke at the Loudoun Nelson Community Center in Santa Cruz, California, in a benefit for Free Radio Santa Cruz in February 2009. Michael Parenti is one of this country's foremost independent political analysts. He's the author of numerous books, including the highly acclaimed The Assassination of Julius Caesar. His latest is Contrary Notions. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. We offer AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Maud Barlow, Tariq Ali, Robert Fisk, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, and Vandana Shiva. To access our vast audio catalog, including other Michael Parenti programs, and to find out about subscribing to AR so you don't miss a single program, we offer CD, MP3, and printed transcript subscriptions, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Michael Parenti on the Hypocrisies of Capitalism, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Judy Roderick. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Once I built a railroad, I made it run. I made it run against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Hey, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun of bricks and mortar and land. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Hey, buddy, can you? Dressed up in khaki suits, yeah, gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee Doodle Dome.
Would you like to help Cable Community Radio grow and prosper? Do you have an interest in nonprofit finances and operations? We have a job opening for finance coordinator. This is a 30-hour per week position with full benefits, including medical. Starting pay is $18 to $22 per hour. You will work with staff, volunteers, and CPAs to support KBU through account management, financial analysis, and reporting. For a full description, please visit kbu.fm/employment. Resume, cover letter, and application are required. If you have any questions, please email station manager Arthur Davis at manager@kbu.org. The deadline for applications is Friday, March 20th, 5 p.m. We look forward to hearing from you.
And it is 1 minute before 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO in Portland, and coming right up, it will be Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. And then stay tuned for Flashpoints at 10:15 and at 11. Today, it's the food show, and they're going to talk about potatoes. So here's Air Cascadia.